This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Animal Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews about animals and people who work with and study them. Temple Grandin has written extensively about autism and the connection she sees between the behavior of people with autism and animal behavior. Grandin is autistic. When she was young, doctors recommended that she be institutionalized, but her mother refused. Grandin has worked to educate people about what it's like to live with autism. She's also fought for reforms in the livestock industry. She has her doctorate in animal science, teaches courses on livestock behavior and facility design at Colorado State University, and consults with the livestock industry on livestock handling and animal welfare. She spent a lot of her career designing humane handling facilities for farm animals. I recorded this interview with her last January after the publication of her book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Temple Grandin, welcome back to Fresh Air. As we've discussed before in the show, you see similarities between animal behavior and autism. And in your new book, you say that, you know, one of the signs that an animal may be troubled is if they're engaging in really repetitive, compulsive behavior. What are some of those behaviors, and how does that relate to autism, too, in humans?
Well, when I was a little kid, I used to do stereotypic or repetitive behaviors. I'd sit for hours and dribble sand through my hands. Sometimes I rocked. Some children afflict the fingers in front of their eyes. I did this because loud sounds hurt my ears. So I did it to escape the loud sounds. And then I would just get fascinated watching all little sand grains, you know, go through my fingers, you know, sort of studying them like a scientist. And the thing is, if I'd been allowed to do that all day, I wouldn't be here now doing an interview. I don't know where I would be. Stereotypic behavior, repetitive behavior is highly abnormal. But there's different things that can motivate it. And this is the basis of the first chapter in the book. And I need to give my co-author, Catherine Johnson, credit for coming up with the idea of linking stereotypic behavior motivation back to Jack Panksepp's core emotions, which are fear, rage, separation anxiety, and seeking. And when I first started out, fear motivated me to do the stereotypic behavior because the loud sounds made me scared. And then seeking would take over, and I would just study the little grains of sand. I want to say that, you know, repetitive behavior is extremely abnormal. The nervous system is not working normally when an animal or a person is doing hours of repetitive stereotypies.
What are some of the typical, like, animal repetitive behaviors that are a sign that something's wrong? Like, we've all known dogs who chase their tail endlessly. Would that be an example?
That would be an example of pacing in a lion or a polar bear. A tongue rolling. Recently I saw some Jersey cows putting their heads up in the air and just waggling their tongues all around. That's totally abnormal. A gerbil that just sits in the corner digging and digging and digging constantly. That's abnormal. The main thing about a stereotypy is it's just sort of is exactly the same over and over and over again. An animal that's pacing will, you know, wear down the floor right where he paces.
So how did you break out of your repetitive behaviors, like, you know, watching grains of sand or rocking back and forth?
I had very good early education starting at 2.5, and I was only allowed to have an hour a day where I could do that sort of thing. And when I was in my bedroom, I'd spin this little brass thingamajig round and round and round that was on the bed frame. The rest of the time, I was kept tuned in. Speech therapy, hours of turn-taking games. I was expected to sit at the table and have table manners and pass the potatoes when they needed to be passed. You know, everybody worked with me to keep my brain connected to the world. I was allowed to only have an hour a day after lunch where I could space out and revert back to autism.
And was that a pleasurable hour?
Yes, that's the thing about it, is stereotypies actually are pleasurable. They calm you down. And I think it's okay for an autistic kid to have a little bit of downtime where they can do these things and calm down. But if you let them do it all day, they're never going to get anywhere because the brain is shutting out the world.
So do you feel like you have any insights about how to break animals of that kind of, you know, like repetitive compulsive behavior?
Well, you've got to start looking at what does that animal do in the wild. You take the polar bear, he's a nomad animal. He walks for miles and miles and miles and miles. Grazing animals like cattle tend to get mouth stereotypies because what do they do all day? They eat. Gerbils will get into digging stereotypies. But what gets interesting is looking at the motivation. A polar bear he's seeking stuff to do. That's why he walks and walks and walks. Now, the gerbil, they thought, okay, let's make a good environment for a gerbil. Let's just give him more sand to dig in. Well, he still spends all 30% of his day digging and digging and digging. You know, but what the gerbil really wants is a place to hide because it's a prey species animal. And he's trying to dig a hole in the bottom of the aquarium, and he can't make a tunnel. Well, if you give him a tunnel, even a fake one, he'll go in there. That gives him cover. And he's digging because he feels exposed. You know, that stereotypy was motivated by fear, where the stereotypy in the polar bear was motivated by seeking.
In your new book, Animals Make Us Human, you describe cats as having a high level of OCD behavior, obsessive-compulsive disorder behavior. What are some examples of that that you see?
Well, you can get a laser pointer out there, and boy, the cat won't stop chasing it. Now, some cats don't go after a laser pointer, but there are some cats, you get a laser pointer, they're just obsessed. In fact, you have to be careful with a laser pointer not to injure a cat, because he can get so much into chasing that little red dot that he can injure himself if you're not careful about how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that can get kind of weird is sometimes a cat can't figure out how to get out of a tree. I had a weird situation when I was a child with our Siamese cat. We had one of these old-fashioned dishwashers that pulled out like a big file drawer, and Billy got underneath the dishwasher, and he was pawing out through the crack out into the kitchen, meowing, trying to go forward. All he had to do to get out was to just back up and, you know, go out around and come out from underneath the sink, and he couldn't figure out how to do that, so I had to slowly, very, very slowly push the dishwasher in to very slowly let him back up and get out.
Now, one of the things you've been doing for many years is consulting to the livestock industry on humane handling of livestock. You've consulted on cattle, pigs, chickens. Anything I'm leaving out?
Sheep, I've done some.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think the first animals you worked with like that were cows. And you built humane chutes to get the cows to slaughter. In doing this kind of work, and in trying to find humane ways of keeping the livestock while they're alive and getting them to slaughter when they're killed, you've had to really understand how animals process information and how their senses compare to human senses, because some things that would upset animals wouldn't upset us. So unless we understand what upsets animals, we can't design humane systems for them. Let's start with cows. Can you compare what you know about how cows process information and what they find upsetting in terms of what they hear or see or smell that most humans would not?
Animals, I mean, especially cattle, notice visual detail, things that move rapidly, things that are high contrast. When I first started out working with the slaughter plants, I had to figure out, do they know they're getting slaughtered? So I'd go over to the Swift plant in Arizona, this was back in the early 70s, and then I'd go out down to a feed yard and watch them in the vaccinating chute, and they behaved exactly the same way. And then I started to figure out, what are they really scared of? So I'd get down in the chutes and see what they were seeing, and they were scared of shadows, reflections, a chain hanging down, seeing a person walking by up in the front of the chute. And if you got rid of these things that the animals are afraid of, and the animals will walk right up the chute really, really easily. I'm still doing that kind of consulting. Just last week, I went out to two plants, and in one of them, I found five distractions that were causing cattle to balk that they had not seen. And they were simple things, a moving yellow hose, some spraying water, a flashing light. They were simple things, but they just didn't see them.
So what happens if cattle see a yellow light or a moving hose or something that distracts them and actually scares them as they're on their way to slaughter? I mean, they're going to get killed, right? So why are we worried that they're going to be a little upset beforehand?
Well, you could say the same thing. You know, you get some old grandmother in a nursing home and say, well, let's just throw her over in the corner. She's going to die of cancer tomorrow. That doesn't matter. I mean, it gets back to relieving suffering, and there's no reason for it to be scary. In fact, there's been some research on the cortisol, the stress levels at the slaughterhouse and at the farm vaccinating chute. Yes, there is stress in both places. It's the same in both places.
You found that a lot of employees, both at livestock facilities and at slaughterhouses, don't really believe that animals have emotions.
Well, actually, the hourly employees aren't the ones that are a problem. It's some of these business manager types. I remember one time a vice president of a great big pig company said, asked me in all seriousness, do pigs have emotions? Well, if you look at the structure of the brain, that's really pretty silly, because the emotional circuits, let's get back to these core emotions of fear, rage, separation, anxiety, and seeking, these are subcortical brain systems. They are the same in all mammals. They have been completely mapped. Some of that research by Jack Panskap and others was done back in the 60s. I can remember in the 60s in psychology class learning about the rage cat. You know, you put electrode in the rage center and the cat goes into a rage.
My guest is Temple Grandin. She's written extensively about how being autistic has given her insights into animal behavior. Her latest book is called Animals Make Us Human. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written a lot about autism, a condition that she has. And she's also written a lot about the connection between animals and autism. And her new book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. You've consulted about cattle. You've also consulted about pigs. What's some of the worst things that you found about the condition that pigs are typically kept in, the pigs who are bred for their meat?
One of my biggest concerns is overloading the biological system. Just pushing, pushing, pushing for more and more and more production to the point where the biological system just starts to fall apart. Bone problems, metabolic problems, weakness. You can push it genetically too hard. You can push it too hard with feed additives and hormones. But this is one of my biggest concerns. I mean, right now, for example, I mean, huge numbers of sows, the mother pigs are lame, and it's just structurally bad legs. You know, the pig companies are starting to correct some of that. But I'm very concerned about this. I'm very concerned about some of the bad dog breeding that's going on, where we just, you know, overselect some stupid appearance trait, or you just overselect for giant muscles or giant milk production. They've got the dairy cow so overselected for milk production now that you have a hard time getting her bred. The embryo just doesn't take.
So because pigs have been bred to create the most meat, we're ending up with, like, physical defects like legs that can't support their weight?
Well, it can support the weight, but you just don't have what's called good leg conformation. You know, you can, I don't want to get into all the different things on leg conformation, but they can be too straight. They can be, you know, the little dew claw things can collapse and they'll be walking on the dew claws. And the bottom line is the end up lame. And I think with all animals, we need to be looking at having, you know, animals that are structurally sound and animals that are mentally sound. You know, some of when we bred the chicken for more and more and more and more eggs. One of the problems was a hyper-excitable chicken. When the pigs were bred, they'd just be super lean. Some of the genetic lines of the super lean pigs were real hyper-excitable.
So what are some of the things you've tried to do to improve the conditions of pigs?
Well, my biggest thing with all the animals is working on handling. I've done a lot of work with many different companies on, you know, loading trucks, you know, how do you handle pigs, training people on handling of animals, the stockmanship. Stockmanship is really, really important. There's been research on stockmanship by Paul Hemsworth, Jeffrey Rushen.
What is stockmanship?
Stockmanship is just being good at animal care. Mm-hmm. Like you work with your animals in such a way that your animals are not afraid of you. Because if your dairy cows are afraid of you or your pigs are afraid of you, they don't grow as well, they don't reproduce as well, they don't give as much milk.
So how do pigs compare to cows, and what scares them, and what therefore what you try to eliminate from their world?
Well, obviously, you want to totally eliminate people that are slapping and hitting and doing those kind of things. But there's differences in how pigs will react, even with two stockmen that are pretty good stockmen. I remember on one farm, there was a guy, and he was, you know, good stockman. He never abused the animals. But then when they got a new lady in the barn to take care of the baby piglets, you know, they actually had more litters weaned, and the sows just felt more relaxed around the lady than they did around the guy.
And what are some of the changes that you've recommended in the handling and the living conditions of pigs?
Well, in handling, just, you know, basic things, move smaller groups, no yelling and screaming. A lot of it's very basic. You know, then they need to learn things like flight zone and point of balance. If you want an animal to go forward, I don't care what species it is, you don't stand in front of the head and poke it on the butt, because now you're telling that animal to go forward and backwards at the same time. You've got to get behind the point of balance at the animal's shoulder, get beyond the behind the shoulder, then it's going to go forward. Just teaching them some of the behavioral principles about animals. And, you know, some people have the temperament to work with animals, and some don't. There's some people that shouldn't be working with animals. But then on the other hand, to have good stockmanship, you can't have a place that's understaffed and where they're overworked, because there's no way that, you know, they can be good at taking care of the animals.
One of the things you've been doing in the livestock industry is creating audits to basically measure the welfare of cows and pigs and chickens. What's an audit like?
Well, basically, you manage things that you measure. You know, you manage weight gain, but nobody's measuring handling. One of my biggest frustrations is I'd go out to a farm or I'd go out to a slaughter plant and I'd get their handling really good, and they're using an electric prod, hardly any at all. And then I'd come back a year later and the handling was awful. And what had happened is they slowly reverted back to those old rough methods, but they didn't realize it. So the concept that I brought into it was measuring handling. Okay, how many pigs fall down? How many pigs are squealing? How many pigs did you use the electric prod on? If you measure it and count that, then you can tell, is my handling getting better or is my handling getting worse? And I developed an audit system called the American Meat Institute Guideline. Did that about 10 years ago, and that's used by McDonald's and other big companies to audit this slaughter plants. And you go in and you count, you know, how many times they use the prod. Well, sometimes people act good when you're there. So the big new frontier right now is video auditing with video cameras, with people looking in at the handling at the plant over the internet and then scoring it.
So this is done over time, and it's not like, oh, we'll just make everything look good for the one day when Temple Grandin visits, and then we'll go back.
That prevents that kind of problem, because on these video auditing systems, they'll maybe two times a day, you know, they'll score maybe, you know, 20 cattle or, you know, score a few animals, and they never know when they're looking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's five plants now on this system, and it's been going really well.
Now, you've also consulted to the poultry industry. Have you come up with ways to improve poultry slaughter?
Well, one of the big things I've done on that, again, is the measurement system. When I first started working with poultry, I remember going out to this farm. They were catching chickens. It was terrible, running them over with a forklift. And they thought it was normal to have 5 to 6% of the birds having a broken wing. I was watching what they were doing. I go, this is just rough handling. So then in one of the plants, we started measuring it. And we very quickly got it down to 1%. And one of the best ways to clean that up is to put the catching crews on incentive pay. Like each person might get an extra $30 a week if they don't bust up the chickens. And again, just simple measurement improved a lot of things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written extensively about her life with autism. She's written about the connections that she thinks exist between animals and animal behavior and autistic behavior. Her latest book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. You've written about how, because you do have autism, you don't really like physical contact with people. You've chosen to avoid romantic love in your life. You choose to live alone. What about kind of physical contact with animals? Do you enjoy petting them? Do you enjoy things like a cat sitting in your lap and snuggling up against you?
Yes, and I really enjoy stroking an animal. And you don't want to pat an animal. You want to stroke it, kind of just firm strokes like mother's tongue. And I really get a lot of enjoyment if I can stroke an animal and the animal's obviously liking it. Like the kitty will rub up against me and the dog is, Mark, my assistant, had a little dog named Annie. And all she wanted to do when she saw me was to roll over on her belly and have me scratch her belly. And, you know, cattle sometimes, you rub them on the neck just right, they put their head up in the air and they kind of go, oh, that just feels so good. I do get pleasure out of, you know, stroking an animal and seeing that animal get happy when you do it.
What else gives you pleasure beyond work?
Talking about autism with other people, talking about animals with other people, talking about engineering with other people, talking about really interesting stuff. And I can relate to another lady that's got Asperger's. she was giving a talk, and she was telling me that, you know, she and her husband have this great romantic dinners and really nice restaurant with candles and everything else. And that sets the stage for a beautiful romantic conversation on computer data storage systems.
I love it.
Because that's just so interesting. And I can completely relate to that.
Well, Temple Grandin, I really want to thank you for talking with us and coming to Fresh Air again. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Temple Grandin recorded last January after the publication of her book, Animals Make Us Human. Our Animal Week series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Michael Schaefer and his wife rescued Murphy, a sweet, cuddly, and goofy St. Bernard, from a shelter, it led Schaefer into the world of contemporary pet ownership, a world of doggy antidepressants, dog park politics, dog furniture, organic pet food, and a whole service industry of grooming, training, and caretaking. In his book, One Nation Under Dog, Schaefer says America's house pets have worked their way into a new place in the hearts, homes, and wallets of their owners. Schaefer is a journalist who has been a former staff writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, U.S. News and World Report, and the Washington City Paper. Michael Schaefer, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I don't want people to think that your book mocks people who love their animals and mocks people who spend money on their animals. But you do take a look at that phenomenon. So what are you trying to get at in the book?
Well, I guess I wanted to sit down and write a book about how it is that we became this pampered pet nation. You kind of can't go a week or two reading a newspaper without seeing some crazy story about what people do for their animals. You know, it's the dog with the pink mohair sweater, or look at these people. They feed organic cat food. And these stories tend to have a kind of undercurrent of derision in them. You know, this is a sign of frivolity and over-the-top excess, particularly in these dark economic times, this is out of place. And I felt that way when I got a dog. My wife and I remember we were driving to this shelter where we knew this dog we wanted was available. And we were driving, it was about 2.5 hours from our house. And the whole way up, we were talking about how, well, we're not going to become like those people, the ones that we had heard about. And we were saying, you know, we're not going to do this, and we're not going to do this, and we're not going to do this. And, of course, then the dog arrives, and all of that goes out the window. And it doesn't go out the window because he's so cute and melts your heart, although that helps. It goes out the window because a lot of the stuff people do for their pets now is just an inevitable reaction or reflection of the society we live in.
Let me ask you to give an example, and here's the one I'm thinking of. A lot of people make fun of animals who are taking things like antidepressants.
Right.
Your dog on antidepressants. Right. Because of what?
Well, we had jobs, and we had this dog at home. And we live in a little row house in Philadelphia, and our next-door neighbors are retired, and they're home all day. And one night they came to us and said, you know, that dog of yours yaps from the minute you guys leave in the morning till the minute you guys come home. And this was a time when he would also go to the bathroom in the house when we left. We would take turns rushing home at lunch, you know, hoping to head it off, which didn't usually work. And, you know, he was quite clearly in distress. And, you know, I mentioned this to the vet kind of in passing, more thinking, hey, do you have any, you know, behavior type techniques I could do to help him relax? And the vet said, you know, there's a drug for that. It's called separation anxiety. That's the condition he's got. And there is a canine version of a human tricyclic antidepressant. The only actual chemical difference is that the pills are beef flavored. And, you know, this was this thing my in-laws, my uncles were saying, you know, you're giving your dog antidepressants? I mean, what's the matter with this country where even our dogs are on antidepressants? Aren't they supposed to be the happiest creatures in the world? And, you know, I guess if you step back and look at it that way, it seems kind of silly. But as a very practical matter, we should all be so lucky as to have had the positive effect he had from the medication. And, you know, we're at a time when we humans are quite comfortable with psychopharmaceuticals. There was, maybe I shouldn't say this, but there was a time when, you know, all three members of our household were using some sort of antidepressant. now he's the only one. But, you know, it's all just to say that we humans are quite comfortable with this. Lots of people do it. It's not weird. It doesn't mean you're crazy. And as you see this with a lot of things in the pet spending world, where things that we experience and kind of think of as normal, we will go and ask, hey, can I do that for my dog or my cat?
But as you point out in your book, putting your dog on antidepressants because of separation anxiety, mm-hmm. his separation anxiety, mm-hmm. is a reflection on how humans live now.
Absolutely.
I mean, there used to be a time when a family that had a dog typically had a mother homemaker who was there all day, right. who was there with the dog. Or there were kids of different ages, and there was a young kid at home to play with the dog. There was a yard that the dog could run around in. And now you've got dogs cooped up at home with nobody home to play them, nothing to play with them, nothing to occupy them. And so it puts the dog in a position of great discomfort because they have no activity and no company.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, I write in my book that an anthropologist from Mars or something that showed up here and had only the contents of like a PetSmart to look at could figure out a great deal about our human society.
What would they learn?
They would learn, among others. I mean, they, looking at just this question, they would learn that we are a society where two career couples are the norm in a lot of places. And that has led to a whole bunch of things. It's led to more dogs being alone more of the time. It's led to these very elaborate chew toys that I write about, where you know these toys are basically designed to keep the pet entertained during these very long absences of its people, and they have all of these devices to kind of make it complicated to get a piece of food out from the middle, and the idea is that a dog, you know, with this toy thrown to him in the morning as the owner heads off for the day, we'll actually spend a couple of hours trying to manipulate it and chew on it in a certain way that makes the food pop out and so on. And at the end of that, the dog will be exhausted. He'll be mentally stimulated, which is great on a theoretical level. He also won't spend the rest of the day destroying your couch, which has a more practical benefit for humans. So people still want pets. They want them, I think, more than they ever did. And they are adjusting the nature of pet keeping in such ways as to reflect the other aspects of how we live.
And that's part of the reason why a whole pet services industry, a huge pet services
right.
industry has grown
right.
up.
Right.
Give us an overview of some of the services available for pets now.
Well, you can find some really crazy examples of wealth and excess in pet services, and you can also find some very practical things.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a day driving around Manhattan with this pet taxi driver, and his company would take calls from people saying, you know, I need to take my dog to the vet. Manhattan's a place where a lot of people don't have cars, and you can't just take any old pet on the subway, and a lot of cabs won't stop for you. So it's actually a practical need that was being filled. And there's also this incredibly fast-growing business of professional dog grooming. And, you know, to me, it is connected fairly intimately with this change in where people's pets have literally lived over the years. In the old days, it was pretty common to have your dog especially sleep out back for the night in the doghouse or out in the yard. I actually saw an article in a business journal that sort of traced images of dogs in advertisements in women's magazines over the course of the 20th century. And in the 1920s, the sort of prototypical picture would be of a stylish woman out on the street walking her dog in public. And by the 50s, you'd have the dog kind of curled up on the hearth in the living room. And by the 80s and 90s, you had this image of, you know, like an aspirin ad where the mom is supplying medicine to the sick child and the dog is literally on the child's bed. So it's this kind of progression indoors and into the family and into the bedroom. I don't think it's any surprise, given that I think I saw a statistic that said 47% of people have their pet sleep in their own bed. I don't think it's any surprise given
sleep in the people's bed.
Sleep in the people's bed. I don't think it's any surprise given that those people are going to be a lot more interested in getting their dog groomed because you don't want to sleep with a stinky dog.
In talking about services, one of the services that you've both researched and taken advantage of is pet hotels, the more high-end kennels that you
right.
can board an animal in if you're going away. Give us a sense of the range of things that you've seen in looking at the high and low range
right.
kennels that are available.
Well, for a lot of people, if they go out of town, the easiest thing to do is they just go to their vet, and the vet will have a few kennels, and the dog can stay there. This used to be pretty standard. To a lot of people, it's now thought of as kind of cruel, and that, you know, it'll be in some dank room in the vet's office and these mom-and-pop vets. And you have seen this tremendous proliferation of pet hotels. The biggest of the pet stores, PetSmart and I believe Petco, are getting into this business as well because it's growing very fast. But I saw it, and I visited a place in San Francisco called the WAG Hotel, where there are several types of rooms you can choose from, but the largest and most lavish of them have TVs and, you know, beds and a video camera that lets the owner, who was presumably on vacation someplace, log on and actually look at their
webcam.
A webcam, right. And then the owner can then call the hotel or email and say, boy, you know, my dog looks hungry. Can you please bring him a treat? And, of course, that costs extra. But this place cost, I believe, $85 a night, which is, you know.
Significant.
more than a lot of Motel 6s.
Yeah. You got your dog from a shelter. And that's, I think, for a lot of people, the preferred way of getting a pet. Because you get to rescue an animal who that's been abandoned or was homeless. How are shelters changing?
You know, the world of where pets come from stands at great contrast to the rest of the pet industry. There are professional market research types who can tell you exactly how many brands of high-end pet shampoo came on the market in the year 2006, for instance. But people have only a relatively foggy idea of where pets come from, how many of them come from so-called puppy mills, how many of them are purchased in stores, how many of them come from rescues or breeders or what have you. But one of the phenomena of recent years, which is related to this campaign against cruel puppy mills that mass breed puppies in often inhumane conditions, has been that the shelters themselves and the advocates for adoption are trying to compete on a kind of market level. So you have, in the old days, you would have to go to the Pound, which was often in a bad part of town, and it was a miserable place where all these dogs are howling, and you know that the ones you don't pick are going to be euthanized, and if you're with your kid's going to start crying, and it's going to be a very unhappy and stressful day for everyone. Instead, I went to a place in Chicago called Paws, which might have been the most beautiful space I set foot in that entire week. It was like a Restoration Hardware or something. It was a beautiful retail environment. It had enormous bay windows, so the sun kind of dappled in, and they had arranged the dogs' rooms in such a way as that there were no sight lines from one dog to another, which is something that causes howling. So there wasn't this kind of cacophony of unhappy howls. The experience there is so pleasant. I mean, this is the argument, is that you make the experience pleasant, make it retail, make it customer friendly, people will be more eager to adopt pets rather than to buy them in ways that often abet a really cruel system.
My guest is journalist Michael Schaefer. He's the author of the new book, One Nation Under Dog. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Michael Schaefer, and his new book is called One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. I know that there are dog parks in most cities. Do you have a dog park to take Murphy to?
Not officially. In my neighborhood, there's, but it's interesting you ask that, because when we got Murphy and began taking him to this park in the neighborhood where everybody takes their dogs, you know, it was like I was Margaret Mead and it just landed in Samoa. There was this very intricate network of rules and what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do, and no one wrote them down, no one told you them, but you just sort of figured them out, and you could see how the people who were regulars at the park would, you know, shun people who engaged in behavior that wasn't cool, remind you of what you're supposed to do. You know, heaven forbid that you let your dog poop and don't pick it up, because everyone will remind you. But there's other types of things which, as I went around, I visited a lot of dog parks. There's great variation among dog parks, and even these informal ones, in terms of what is permitted and what isn't. And I'm not, again, talking about a written list of rules.
Give me an example.
Well, in my neighborhood, I live in a sort of college-y neighborhood right by a university. And one thing dogs do in dog parks is they hump. And you know, most of the time people have a kind of dogs will be dogs attitude. Well, you know, that's what they do. They're dogs. And, you know, sometimes if there's a new person, people will try to get their dog to not do that because they don't know how the new person will react. But that tends to be how it works. There's another very nice, actually legal, official dog park in a kind of ritzy part of town that we take our dog to sometimes. And there, it's really not okay. And there, again, there's no sign that says no humping. But you can tell from the way everyone else is reacting that when Murphy is mounting another dog, that it's not at all acceptable and they really don't like that and they don't know who you are and they kind of want you to go away.
So are you a regular now at the dog park? You know all the rules?
I'm a regular there not because I know all the rules but because it's the closest thing to my house.
Right, right. Okay.
And it's actually been a place where, you know, I spend an hour a day there. And I've made a lot of friends. And one of our closest friends in our city is someone we met through the park. And I think this is quite typical, this
but
idea
that,
of...
That's a point you make in your book, that dogs are a way of connecting to other people in addition to having a connection to the dogs and in a society where we're growing increasingly isolated.
Right. And this is something that's been the subject of a certain amount of scholarly research, but it's something I've also sort of experienced in my own life at my neighborhood dog park. And I've also sort of seen it in action and I've written about some of the business people who are trying to take advantage of it. In Austin, Texas, I remember visiting a bar that had a yappy hour, I believe, every Wednesday or Thursday night. And it was a great idea. I mean, whoever
thought
of it.
Bring your pet with you?
Bring your pet with you. And you know, it was outdoors and they had put out some dog bowls and probably a quiet night of the week. And it was a great way of drumming up business. The people who were there loved it because for them, having to rush home from work every day and walk the dog, while a pleasure, also sort of impeded on their social life a little bit, and this was a way to combine the two. And as ornate as a lot of city dog parks may be now, very few of them serve beer.
You know, you mentioned earlier that more people seem to have pets now than ever before. And if that's true, have you thought about the reasons why that might be true?
The most convincing of the reasons I've heard, and I can't claim to have come up with it myself, traces the point where the growth of the pet population began to grow faster than the human population to the 1960s, late 60s. And the argument is that this is the same time when we began moving further from families and more divorce and people leaving tight-knit urban neighborhoods in favor of a more isolated suburban lifestyle and a kind of broad array of social support mechanisms going away. And that one thing people did was turn to pets to help fill that void. And I think it also explains the role that pets were given in this new world, that they were considered much more as full-fledged members of the family with all of our obligations to them than in the old days. If you walk through a pet cemetery, you know, you can kind of see this in real time. Some of the very old graves are likely to say or liable to say, you know, here lies Fido, a loyal servant. And newer ones you'll find, you know, here lies Fido, my best friend. Or often, and there are all these internet sites where people can write tributes to their recently deceased pets, and it'll say, my baby, or Fido was my child, except that his name is not so likely to be Fido anymore. I actually saw some statistics from a pet insurance company about what the most common names of policyholders was, and it was like Max and Jake and Chloe and Julie, which are also pretty common names for babies nowadays.
My guest is journalist Michael Schaefer, author of the new book One Nation Under Dog. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Michael Schaefer, and he's the author of the new book One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. You have a chapter on basically dog training culture wars. You compare two different styles
right.
of dog training. And what are the different styles and what do they tell you about our culture today?
Right. Well, there is the number of, according to the federal government, the number of animal trainers in the country tripled in just 6 years between 2000 and 2006. And, you know, one of the reasons for this is as I said, that getting dog training has become, for a lot of middle-class pet owners, a kind of basic, normal responsible thing you do to be a good citizen. And there has been this wildly popular and really good TV show called The Dog Whisperer, starring Cesar Millan, which is like a weekly advertisement for the concept of dog training. You see him go, you know, you might imagine hiring a dog trainer is something that only, you know, absurdly rich people do, or you only do if you want to train a seeing eye dog or a stunt dog or something. And that's how it used to be, or at least you'd only do if you had kind of a problem dog. And, you know, watching The Dog Whisperer, you actually see him go into these houses of perfectly normal people. And granted, normal people whose dogs are acting in ways they don't want, but people who are not fancy spendthrift types. The thing is, though, that this growth of this industry has masked or hasn't made up for the fact that there are wildly divergent views about what the most effective and most humane way to train a dog is. For most of the 20th century, since the sort of dawn of kind of modern dog training, which was geared, again, towards police dogs and Hollywood dogs and whatever, it was this very rote military-style training. Actually, the first prominent dog trainer was in the Prussian police force. So you can imagine it was sort of in his image, and it was, if the dog, you know, doesn't behave in the right way, jerk its chain. And that idea kind of carried through most of the 20th century. There was this pedagogical revolution in the 70s and 80s among trainers who thought, hey, maybe actually positive reinforcement, you know, hitting him with a reward as quickly as possible after he does something well, is a more effective way to train. The argument was that dogs are too dumb to figure out why it is you're kicking them. So if you were trying to correct some bad behavior, it's difficult to do that through these purely negative ways. At this positive reinforcement model kind of became the standard among professionals, and academically based professionals as well as trainers and who might hang out a shingle and so on, until Caesar's show went on the air. And his idea is quite different. It's that, you know, there is this natural order of things as existed in a pack of wild wolves, where the alpha dog was the boss and the other dogs were subordinate. And his idea is the way you the problem for American dogs, the problem with their behavior, is that we have lost touch with the natural order of things. And that the way to shape a dog's behavior is to remind it that you, the human, are its alpha. Which seems good in theory, but to a lot of the positive trainers, the ways he gets to that are considered cruel or at least impractical. And they see all this sort of talk about nature as just a mask for a return to this old-fashioned, dominant, top-down model. And to my mind, it all plays out kind of like a version of the culture wars over how to raise a kid. You know, we've got one side based in institutions and universities that has a softer, more positive approach. You have another side that says our society has gone amiss because we've lost our discipline and lost our sense of authority. And, you know, it sounds awfully familiar.
Which kind of which approach did you go with your training?
We hired a woman who, because we didn't know anything about this, hired a woman who had a good website and we liked her a lot, who had a kind of alpha approach. And it was this, you know, when you go through a door, you go first. Murphy doesn't go first. That way
you got to teach him who's boss.
Right. And when you come home, don't pet him. Once he has calmed down, call him over to the couch and then pet him. And she was we really like her. And she, you know, things I'm saying may, you know, sort of removed from the experience might sound kind of monstrous, but the argument was this is what will make him feel better. That, you know, any behavior problems he has have to do with anxiety over who's the boss. And that dogs, unlike humans, are not sitting around scheming, hoping to become the boss, but that what they do need is a secure sense of where they are in the order of things. So it was, you know, put out his food for exactly 20 minutes a day, then put it away. He has to know that he's going to eat on your schedule, not on his. And, you know, he doesn't get to come on the bed. And when you walk him, you know, hold the leash tight and he doesn't get to decide where you go and that sort of thing. And it, you know, it worked.
Michael Schaefer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Schaefer is the author of One Nation Under Dog. Our Animal Week series continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by jazz singer Chris Connor. She died of cancer Saturday. She was 81.